Welcome to Thoughts on Record, podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. I'm your host, Dr. P. Kelly. Each week, we explore topics of interest relevant to mental health clinicians and consumers. That said, if you're generally interested in psychology, the brain, dynamics of human behavior, and other aspects of the incredible journey that is the human experience, you've come to the right place. Now, without further delay, here's today's episode. Dr. Kieran Vagada obtained his PhD in clinical psychology from Concordia University in Montreal. He completed his pre-doctoral internship at McGill University Health Center and supervised practice at the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. He provides psychodiagnostic assessment and treatment for adult attention hyperactivity disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and borderline personality disorder. He also provides treatment for adults and the elderly who are struggling with mood and anxiety-related disorders. Dr. Vagada uses an integrative approach to treatment drawing from cognitive, behavioral, interpersonal, and mindfulness traditions. All right, Dr. Kieran Vagada, welcome back to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Pete. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, Kieran, it's so nice to have you back on the podcast and to be able to connect to have a discussion around an area or approach that I know is really popular, but I must admit that I do not have a firm grounding and really just only sort of a surface awareness. Like, I'm really looking forward to learning a lot from you and seeing how we can take these really big, interesting ideas, which can be quite abstract, and translate them into our everyday lives and practice to try and improve perhaps our own quality of life, but certainly the quality of life of our clients as well. So again, I'm really excited to have you here today. So the major topic for today is mindfulness of feelings from a Buddhist psychology perspective. I think there's so much interesting stuff in there we could pick apart. Kieran, I want to know why this is a topic that matters to you. Why is this something that you've, you know, wanted to speak to today?
So I'll have to give you a little bit of context then, a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to keep it short. So when I was introduced to mindfulness meditation when I was 24 years old, and when I did my first meditation retreat, a 10-day meditation retreat, I realized, you know, this is where I want to spend the rest of my life. You know, I really want to figure out how this mind-body works. And I was very fascinated with the Buddhist teachings. So since then, every year I've been going for a 10-day meditation retreat, you know, practicing for like, you know, 100 hours, 100 hours 10-day meditation retreat, and then daily practice of 1 to 2 hours a day. And I've seen a lot of progress in terms of how I feel about things, in terms of my emotions and so on and so forth. So it's been 22 years, to be exact, that I've been practicing this mindfulness. But in the last 2 years, I started to, you know, have certain questions regarding the approach of mindfulness and, you know, looking at even at the client populations. You know, it's a very difficult thing. It's very difficult to sell. People have difficulty practicing it. And in terms of understanding, you know, we really don't know how the mindfulness works, even in the literature. There are certain assumptions, there are certain theories, but, you know, it's all about testing them out. So this is where, you know, I started to experiment slightly differently, my own mindfulness practice, looking at the original source of Buddhist teachings. And then I realized what is the missing link between the Western psychology and the Eastern psychology. And the, you know, the source of suffering is we don't understand what feelings are. And that is where, you know, the game can begin. So that is where I'm interested to talk about what feelings are and how Buddha conceptualizes feelings, how we understand feelings in the Western psychology, and how to tie them together.
Kieran, I really want to ask you, because I think others in the audience might be interested, what is the psychological or even physical experience of a 10-day retreat like?
First, I mean, it's hard, but it's not impossible.
And if someone wanted to do something like that, Is it sort of like a ladder that you would progress down? Would you maybe start with a day or a daily practice, something like that? Is this something you need to work up to? Would you recommend that someone not jump into a 10-day retreat as their very first immersion experience in this?
I would say, you know, you can just go for a 10-day meditation retreat. It's okay. I think in my understanding, let's say like 90% of the people who go to the meditation retreat, they stay for 10 days. The dropout rate is only 10%. So that's pretty good number, you know, in my opinion. So one should experiment. It's in the first day is hard, second day is hard. The third day, fourth day, fifth day, the mind settles down and you tend to discover and experience things differently.
And how much integration do you have to do after that particular experience? Like, is it sort of in the days and weeks that follow, are you integrating a lot of the stuff that's come up, or is that done? Does it feel like it's sort of done in real time as you're there?
So in terms of integration, you know, because the retreats that I used to go, they are based on certain techniques, techniques of concentration of breath and, you know, awareness of body. So there is no insight, there is no wisdom that is happening as you're doing the exercise. And once you are engaging in the real world, the wisdom may arise, but that is depending upon the luck and the technique that you're practicing. In my 18 years of my meditation experience, I've seen, you know, improvement of my emotions. You know, I don't feel as strongly about things. I don't feel anger or, you know, the frustration and so on and so forth. But I don't think I become a wiser person by practicing the mindfulness techniques. And the reason I realized is the way we understand mindfulness is from awareness perspective, you know, can I observe things? Can I be aware of these things? But there's another aspect of mindfulness which is very important is understanding how things work, how the pleasant feeling is turning into an unpleasant feeling, how the unpleasant feeling can be turned into a pleasant feeling, how a thought is arising, how a body is tightening. Understanding that is also mindfulness. And that is the integration part. That needs to be done at every moment, Pete, because otherwise, you know, the tendency of the mind is to grasp to pleasure and minimize pain. We always have to work opposite to this tendency of the mind. That is mindfulness.
And we're certainly going to talk about that and the real challenges that can present for many of us. Before we get too far down the rabbit hole, I want to give people a quick primer on some of the assumptions of Buddhist psychology, and then maybe compare and contrast that with Western psychology, things of that nature, secular mindfulness. So Karen, would you mind maybe sort of leading us through a bit of an overview of some of the assumptions of Buddhist psychology, and then how we can relate that to practices we as clinicians might be more familiar with on a day-to-day basis?
Super. The first assumption of Buddhist psychology is the impermanent nature of reality. In other words, reality equals to change. And the second assumption is the impersonal nature of reality, which means things are happening because of certain causes and conditions. So these are the two basic assumptions. And if you look at our Western psychology, these assumptions are consistent with our Western psychology assumptions as well. For instance, in terms of behavior therapy, there we assume, you know, our stimulus response is somewhat conditioned. And also we assume that our thinking is conditioned about how we feel. If I'm feeling tired, then I may experience thoughts of sadness. If I'm feeling a little bit energetic, I may experience thoughts of excitement or anxiety. So thoughts are also conditioned. And the secular mindfulness traditions talk about the experience of these, you know, mind-body phenomena. So there's a lot of emphasis on awareness. So they all of them tie together, in my opinion, the Western and the Eastern psychology. But what is missing is, how are things happening? How are feelings arising? How are feelings passing away? That we have not investigated so far in the Eastern and the Western psychology.
So you mentioned a couple of things, the impermanent nature of reality and the impersonal nature of reality, if I've got that correct.
That's correct, yeah.
And I think those are really deep, resonant intellectual ideas. I'm all in, I'm on board, it makes sense. What I find happens within myself when I approach those ideas as far as implementing within my own real life, there's a lot of pushback, resistance, foot stomping, maybe even a temper tantrum or two internally around some of these things. And I've certainly seen this in clients as well. When I try to lay out the case for change within the context of this particular framework or orienting to things that are going on in our life in a different way, again, through the lens of this, you know, impermanence and impersonal nature, there's real resistance, sometimes outright anger, a sense of invalidation, being dismissed. People want their reality. They want it to be personal, and they want it to be permanent. They want there to be control, certainty, so on and so forth. Has that been your experience with clients? Has that been your experience within yourself? How can we help people to move towards embracing some of these, again, I think really interesting and resonant ideas, but which are very unhuman in a sense to embrace?
I agree with you, Pete, completely. I agree that, you know, in my opinion, I think we have evolved to survive. We have not evolved to be happy. And what is the principle of survival? Principle of survival is maximization of pleasure and minimization of pain. But the more we try to maximize pleasure is no longer pleasurable. the more we try to minimize pain, the pain is getting bigger and bigger. So our minds are inherently biased. And that bias is where the suffering arises. So in other words, I acknowledge, yes, this is very difficult. You know, change is very difficult. But I will also ask a question, is it the same body that is when I was born? It is not a different body. It's a different body, right? But when I look at the mirror every day, the body looks the same. So that is where the illusion is, you know. Our mind does not perceive change. Earth is revolving. We don't perceive that change. You know, electrons are evolving. We don't perceive that change. Emotions, we don't perceive that change. But there's something beneath our conscious mind. There is something called feeling that is happening. It is a stream that is always changing. If one can train ourselves to be aware of our feelings, what are pleasant feelings, what are neutral feelings, what are unpleasant feelings, how they're arising, and we see the changing nature, then we can gain a lot of wisdom and freedom. So in other words, you know, it is. I would invite people to experiment and have an open mind and see if it works for them or not. And I would say resistance and anger are these are the initial obstacle one experiences as they experiment with these type of, you know, approaches.
Yeah, and you may have just answered this question, but one question I did have was, I like to help people to orient to knowing when they are stuck. I think doing that sort of self-diagnosis is very important to understand when a certain type of coping isn't working anymore. We need to stop, reassess. Just getting unstuck in itself can be, you know, hugely impactful. Can you give people a sense of some of the cues or clues along the way that would let them know that they're struggling against some of these maybe immutable aspects of reality?
In other words, you know, I will go back to the feeling or the emotion. Like whenever we get stuck, we are experiencing a particular emotion. Let's say it can be, you know, feeling helpless or feeling angry, feeling frustrated. And I would ask, what is this feeling? What is this emotion? It's a very unpleasant feeling. It's a very unpleasant experience. The best way to overcome unpleasant experience is to let go of something that you're holding very tightly in your mind. Whatever you're holding tightly could be a rule, could be a virtue. You wanted things in a certain way. But the reality is everything is subject to change. It doesn't matter how smart you are, how powerful you are, still this change will happen. In other words, I would say uncertainty and loss is a very universal phenomenon. From uncertainty arises anxiety, and from loss arises sadness. So anxiety and sadness are universal emotions. Don't take it personally. When we start taking it personally, that is when other emotions arise. From anxiety arises fear, because the mind doesn't like uncertainty. So what does it do? It makes a prediction. And when it makes a prediction, it makes a worst case prediction. And that is when fear arises. And the fear is felt in the mind, and the fear is also felt in the body. And from then, you know, again, the same thing with sadness. The mind doesn't like sadness, but the mind doesn't like loss. The moment it's fighting the loss, anger arises. I blame the outside world for this loss, or I blame myself for this loss. That's when guilt arises. So anger, sadness, guilt, anxiety, fear is arising because the mind is resisting and not accepting the actual nature of reality that is the change.
Karen, I'm not sure if you have a thought on this or not. Certainly with respect to anger, angry rumination, things like that can be so destructive psychologically, but my experience of it in listening to clients, I have an intuition around it that is actually really reinforced initially. There's something quite rewarding, satisfying, self-soothing that comes with sort of marinating in that anger and internal irritability. That seems so counterintuitive when I say it out loud, but that's been my felt experience of it. And again, you see clients that will want to come in and tell you their story over and over and over again, sort of like about like how they are hard done by or something terrible was done to them. And indeed, that might be the case. And clearly they're stuck. We can see this from the outside looking in, but there seems to be something very conditioned and reinforced about going through this narrative over and over and over again, no matter how psychologically unpleasant it might be. How, from the lens that we're building out today, why might that be the case?
I would say anger, for instance, is actually a pleasant feeling. Our mind is addicted to a pleasant feeling. Because, for instance, you know, when we are experiencing anger, the mind holds a certain virtue, right and wrong. just and unjust. And in the body, there is an experience of heat and energy. The only way we can let go of anger is first to become aware that there is anger in the mind and not push it away, not judge it. Because the moment you judge it, you're suppressing that anger turns inwards. It becomes more guilt. So you recognize there is an anger and ask yourself, what are you experiencing in the mind and body? Oh, in the mind is holding to a certain rule. People should not cut me off when I'm driving. Right? That's what the mind is saying. The expectation is the people should follow the rules on the road. That is the expectation. So, but that expectation is also based on certain conditions and certain causes. In Ottawa, maybe people cut me off 5% of the time. In Toronto, 20% of the time. Maybe in India, 85% of the time. Ultimately, that is the wisdom part, recognizing things are happening, you know, because of certain causes and conditions, and there's a certain frequency to the event. So changing those expectations in the mind, we can let go of the anger.
All right. I'm loving just playing this out just a little bit because it sort of deeply resonates personally in a sense. What do you think then is the line between feeding an expectation strategically and constructively versus feeling subjugated and like you are being unduly controlled by something? Because I think that's the cul-de-sac that I always end up in, you know, in some of these struggles is I don't want to let this sort of other entity win or get over on me. If I feel, I've thought it through, it's like, nope, this is what I believe to be correct. I just abhor having to abandon an expectation, even though it would make, I totally get it. It makes all the sense in the world, but there's just an internal, like, no, we're not doing this. Forget it, to my own detriment and struggle. And again, I see this in clients as well. I certainly know that I'm no different than anybody else in that respect. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I will see it from the kind of, you know, attachment towards certain things. What I've noticed is, you know, we attach to four things in general. One is relationships, you know, people. One is material things, you know, or objects. And third is ideas, Pete. Ideas is the hardest thing to give away. And the fourth is the experiences. Ideas is about right, wrong, what I know, what I don't know. God exists, God doesn't exist. This is hell, this is heaven. All these are ideas. When the mind let go of that idea, there is emptiness. When there is emptiness, there is sadness. And when there is sadness, there is where, you know, sometimes introspection arises. You start asking questions, you know, about what reality is and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I guess it's a way of ultimately managing uncertainty. If I reflect on it in the moment as you're saying that, it's easier to be angry at something than it is to be wandering in some sort of an unknown abyss where you might have to come to as of yet unrealized realizations about something which may be emotionally inconvenient.
Agreed. I would say, I think the ultimate game is managing the uncertainty, managing the loss, and managing the mismatched expectations that we have on the self and the world. I think that is the key towards navigating the life.
I think it's one of those really interesting times in psychology where it's very simple, but very challenging to implement, right? Like that's how it feels to me. Karen, it seems like this might actually be a great time to couch some of what we're talking about in some truth. That is the noble truths. Because it seems to me like as I'm talking through some of these conundrums that there's already a framework that's been developed for, you know, maybe understanding some of the conundrums that I've been describing, experiencing personally as well as through clients as well. So what are the noble truths about reality that we need to start to, or we could entertain embracing?
Definitely. So based on the first two assumptions about the psychology of the permanent nature of reality and the impersonal nature of reality, one of the predictions we can make is there is suffering. Why is there a suffering? Because the tendency of the mind is to grasp onto whatever is pleasant and push away whatever is unpleasant. This pleasant and unpleasant are also conditioned phenomena, sort of ephemeral phenomena, and grasping will lead to dissatisfaction. Fighting pain will lead to dissatisfaction. So first noble truth is there is suffering in life. Very often, when I tell this to people, they do not agree with it. They challenge, no, I'm feeling happy. I'm not suffering. Well, then I cannot argue with them. So only people that I can agree with them are the people who come to my office. When they are coming to my office because they recognize they are experiencing suffering and I am the one to help them out of the suffering. So that is the first noble truth.
Yeah, as you were saying that, Karen, one thing that comes up is to the client or colleague even that might harbor, unrelenting standards. There's often a belief, yeah, that's great for other people, but if I just do everything correctly, if I get everything nailed down, do everything just right, there actually is a path forward that doesn't involve any suffering. We can optimize and gamify the system such that we are able to, you know, sidestep around all that silly suffering that other people, quote unquote, have to deal with. Is that something that you hear?
I agree. And I would say, like, you know, the unrelenting standards is the cause of the suffering. The first noble truth is there is suffering. What is the cause of the suffering? The cause of the suffering is craving. Craving means any mental process that is happening in the mind that says, I like this or I don't like this. I want this, I don't want this. This is me, this is mine. That craving, grasping, and clinging, that mental process is what is causing suffering. I would put it that way. So if I can abandon that part, if I say, you know, instead of saying I like it or I don't like it, if I say I accept whatever it is, neither do I want, I do not want to accept whatever it is. This is not either mine or this is not either me nor mine. Then such a process can help us to overcome suffering.
So I believe the second noble truth is there are causes for suffering. Let's unpack that one a little bit.
The cause is craving. Let's start with, maybe I can give a best example is eating. Okay. So would you agree that one of the most pleasant things that we experience in our day-to-day life would be food?
Absolutely.
Right. When we eat food, how do we eat food? What I've noticed is when we eat food, either we are talking to people, either we are working, we are reading, or we are on the phone. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Then you ask a question, why that may be the case? In my investigation, when we are actually eating the food, it's such a very pleasant feeling. When the feeling is very pleasant, it's very intense. The mind likes to grasp to this feeling, but there's nothing to grasp. So it looks for objects outside, either a thought or, you know, some kind of watching a movie or talking to someone. And the other part of the craving that manifests is in terms of our chewing. The moment we eat the food and we experience a pleasant feeling, the chewing is so automatic. We tend to chew faster. We tend to swallow faster. So feeling, pleasant feeling, and craving are completely glued. In other words, in my understanding is, when we are experiencing pleasant feelings, we are not even aware of it. When we are experiencing neutral feelings, we ignore it. It is only during unpleasant feelings we become aware of it, because our body is screaming at us and the mind is, you know, is dissatisfied. So my approach would be is train yourself to be aware of all the three feeling states, the pleasant feeling states, the neutral feeling states, as well as the unpleasant feeling states. Because the unpleasant feeling states we are experiencing are coming from the pleasant feeling states where the mind was unaware. To give you an example, when I'm eating, if I don't pay attention, the food is pleasant. As I'm eating, the pleasant is turning into neutral. The mind doesn't like it. It takes a second bite to make it pleasant. Same pleasant feeling is turning to neutral. As I'm chewing and swallowing, the mind doesn't like it. Takes the third bite, fourth bite, fifth bite, until maybe a 20th bite when my stomach is hurting, then I realize I need to stop. See how it started out with a pleasant experience, ended with an unpleasant experience, and we were not aware during the pleasant and the neutral experience.
We've established the first truth, there is suffering. The second truth, there is a cause to suffering.
And the third truth is, there's a way out of suffering. And first way out of suffering is the awareness. First understanding, you know, like there is suffering, this is the cause of suffering, and there's a way out of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is about the Eightfold Noble Path. And if I were to, you know, break down this Eightfold Noble Path, it includes certain type of ethical behaviors, training the mind and engaging the mind in wisdom. The ethical behaviors are very straightforward, Pete. You know, don't engage in a behavior that causes harm to you or harm to anyone else. Engage in a behavior that is wholesome, that causes benefit to you and benefit to somebody else. For example, right speech. Ethical behavior here is, you know, speak only truth. But here again, there's a condition. Speak the truth only if it is relevant. Speak the truth only if it is helpful for the others. Speak the truth only if it is kind. Otherwise, maintain silence. So that would be an example of an ethical behavior. In terms of the other part of it is training the mind. Training the mind here means, let's imagine our mind to be both conscious and subconscious. At the conscious level of the mind, we have thinking. And in my opinion, all form of thinking is a form of craving. Craving means I like this, I don't like this. Let's examine our thoughts. You know, in general, most of our thoughts are about preferences. I want this, I don't want this. I ignore this, this is important for me. Then you say, this is me or this is mine. No, it belongs to me, it doesn't belong to me. That is the conscious level of the mind. We have to train ourselves to come to the subconscious level of the mind. So that is where the mindfulness of breath comes into picture. When you train yourself to observe your breath, mind calms down, and you know, at some point you won't even have experienced any thoughts. At that time, you can actually investigate the mind, how the mind, body, and everything works. The third stage is where you examine the mind is the wisdom path. So these are the three aspects of the entire Buddhism, in my opinion. In other words, it's a very, manual-based approach. You don't have to have any like religious context to it.
One thing I was thinking about as you were laying this out, and especially the word craving has come up a number of times, I'm thinking about clients with ADHD, and I know this is a population that you work with quite a bit. This is a population that struggles with all kinds of cravings. There's combined with impulsivity, things like that.
I would say mania too, like bipolar.
Yes, exactly.
Or of cravings, hypomania, yeah.
Borderline personality disorder, perhaps anything within the gambling or eating disorders.
Definitely. So here I'm actually working with those populations and using some of the mindfulness techniques. So if you're interested, I can share some of those.
Yes, please. I'd love to hear more. That's exactly where I wanted to go. I want to hear how we can deploy this kind of like mindset in these clients who are really besieged by tons of cravings. We're like these hedonic drives that are very, very challenging to manage.
Yeah. Right now in our secular mindfulness literature, we only use like three techniques of, you know, mindfulness. But in my opinion, these techniques have limitations. They have strengths, but they also have limitations. In my opinion, we need more techniques, mindfulness techniques to work with certain types of, states of mind. With regards to the ADHD, I work at least with, three types of mindfulness exercises with them. The first one is training them actually how to concentrate, right? Like, I mean, with these ADHD folks, the teachers have told them, concentrate, pay attention. And even, in our contemporary world, people tell us pay attention, but nobody tells us how to pay attention. The first technique is teaching your mind how to concentrate. This technique directly comes from Buddha's teaching about mindfulness of mind. And in my own, experimentation and discovery, what I realized is, we experience thoughts in our mind because our eyes are moving. If we can train ourselves to keep our eyes still, we will not experience thoughts in the mind. That is the first observation. The second observation is, whenever we experience a thought in the mind, we immediately feel the tension in the neck and the shoulders at a very subtle level. And our shoulders go up like this and they tighten. Whenever our shoulders are relaxed, whenever our eyes are still, then it is technically possible not to have a thought in the mind. But the movement of the eyes is so automatic because when we are awake, our eyes are always moving. Because the moment we close our eyes, the eyes tend to move and we start experiencing thoughts in the mind. So the training is how to keep your eyes still, be aware of your breath, and keep your shoulders still. And also check the mind. With each breath, check the mind, whether the mind is concentrated on the eyes or is the mind distracted towards the thoughts. By training in such a way, the more you train, the more you check your mind, is the mind concentrated or distracted, mind concentrated or distracted, you actually train yourself to be more concentrated. So that would be the first exercise I would use with the people who struggle with ADHD. These people also have difficulty with awareness of their body. Generally their awareness is they're mostly in their mind, a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas, They are aware of their body only when body is experiencing some level of pain or some level of agitation. So, and I will train them with the mindfulness of body, wherein I train them how to observe their breath, at the same time how to experience the body, and how to also relax their body using the breath as a relaxant. Then I will teach them how to identify their feelings. Let's say if they have any addictions, let's say if they are smoking, and people with ADHD, their major addiction is smoking to nicotine. This is what I would say. You like cigarettes, right? So cigarette is pleasant for you. Would you not be interested to understand what this pleasant feeling is if your mind is really hooked to it? Right? If you like this food, would you not be interested to just completely experience the food? So there's an incentive to do the mindfulness exercise for them. I would say, take your cigarette, light your cigarette. But before you take your cigarette, just take a few deep breaths and ask yourself, what are you feeling? Is it pleasant? Is it neutral? Or is it unpleasant? The chances are they will say it will be pleasant. The reason being is they're about to smoke, right? The mind is anticipating something. They're feeling some, you know, warmth in their body. They will say it is pleasant. All right. I would tell them, now take a puff. Just take a deep puff. After the puff is over, ask yourself, close your eyes and ask yourself the same question. What am I feeling? Is it pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant? Do it for 5 times. Then they realize as they are taking another puff, the experience is becoming more unpleasant, and more unpleasant. Once they recognize it, and I would tell them, don't think about anything else. Just focus on, is it pleasant? Is it neutral? Is it unpleasant? And how is the mind interpreting that this is pleasant, this is neutral, or this is unpleasant? That is another, and people will be very shocked to see how the mind is interpreting. There's no actual truth, or there's no basis how the mind is interpreting. It is interpreting based on so many other conditions, you know?
If I can just jump in for a second, like, I think this is really an excellent illustration you've laid out of the difference between liking and wanting. And we know there's a biological basis for this. Like, dopamine is this terrible salesperson who really sells us on, this is going to be amazing. As soon as you put that cigarette in, it's going to be awesome. And then you get a dud in the mail kind of thing 2 weeks later. It's a con artist on some level.
And you're seeing that con artist right away as you're doing it, if you pay attention to it.
And that's what I really appreciate about the exercise that you just laid out, is that, you know, often we can maybe consider that in retrospect, but you're providing a framework here where you can see the con artist or the con kind of playing out in real time. You're like, oh, wow, like, this is actually not really worth it if I look at it from this very high resolution, present focused lens.
Definitely. I agree. I feel somewhat confident now to treat a lot of addictions just by doing this mindfulness of feeling exercise. Because my deepest understanding is when we're experiencing pleasant feeling, we are in fact not aware of it. The mind is engaged in craving. You know, the feeling and craving are tied together and the behavior follows immediately. So we have to cut the link between feeling and thinking. To do that, we have to bring our attention inwards and actually ask questions. What am I feeling? And you'll be very surprised, Pete. You know, I did this, you know, for 18 years, I practiced mindfulness in a certain way. In the last 2 years, I changed my mindfulness approach. First time when I did this exercise, you know, I asked myself, what am I feeling? For 20 seconds, my mind was not able to answer. Then I felt shocked. Wow, I thought I know so much about myself. I don't even know what I'm feeling. I felt happy then. Then I realized, I'm feeling pleasant feeling. And I started to investigate, you know, how the mind is actually interpreting such a feeling is pleasant, such a feeling is neutral, such a feeling is unpleasant. And what I recognized was whenever the mind is in a certain state, whenever the mind is concentrated, the feeling is somewhat pleasant. If the mind is alert, the feeling is pleasant compared to being drowsy. If the body is experiencing certain level of heat, it is pleasant. Certain level of, you know, coolness, it is pleasant. So it is based on mind and body interactions. Once you see how it is happening, then the mind becomes much more free and much more happy. In other words, what I have learned is you can generate your own feelings within yourself. A good meditator can close their eyes and within 2 minutes they can feel happy if they want to. But for that, they need to understand what feelings are and how the feelings are changing. There's an investigation aspect to it. It is not just observation, but you're also checking, you know, you're asking your mind certain questions.
Yeah, it sounds like you have to actively excavate that experience. And then once you know sort of the shape and contour of it, then you have more possibility of, quote unquote, manipulating it. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way, but just in a mechanical way.
Exactly. And the best way to manipulate is to relax. Relax and let go. If something is unpleasant, There's a tightness in the body. Okay, then relax the body. There's a tightness in the mind. What is tightness in the mind? You're holding something very tightly. Right, wrong, good, bad. That is it, what the mind is holding. You let go. Then the same unpleasant feeling turns to neutral. And after some time, it turns to pleasant as well.
Again, I want to make this point because you made this before that we have not necessarily been selected for to be happy. We've been selected for to be alive. It doesn't strike me that this is the default setting of the mind to have this layer of this much inquiry and having to be so present focused and such a keen observer of one experiences. I think it feels like the default setting is mindlessness, is just sort of going about the day-to-day, you know, rhythms of biological life without giving it too much thought. I'm making that point because I just want to really impress upon people how if you're finding this challenging, you're not incorrect. Like, it feels like it is challenging to be able to step into this mindset and sort of really go against the evolutionary pressure towards survival, essentially.
I agree. And I think that is where I think maybe Socrates questioning helps for us, you know, like self-inquiry questions helps for us. If we don't do that, then we are mindless, but we ask questions and we come up with a way of, figuring out that question, figuring out an answer for that question. I think that's where the mindfulness, journey begins, in my opinion.
Okay, I have a related question for you. And I think this is sort of about the just applicability of this. Again, given some of the challenges that I've just laid out and you and I have just spoke about, what is the evidence for mindfulness-based interventions? You know, one could, on the surface make the argument if they're really challenging to implement, as we've talked about, they wouldn't be all that effective. But I believe the evidence may speak to the contrary. What is the current evidence base as far as mindfulness-based interventions?
Yes. I will call it, first of all, it's that difficult. It takes practice. A certain 8 weeks of practice for anybody practicing for 20 to 30 minutes, I would say they will see an impact. And some of the new mindfulness techniques that I'm developing, experimenting with my clients, in fact, I can see impact even much quicker. So I think it's not that difficult. I think we should all be open to experiment. In terms of evidence so far, Pete, I would say, it works with pain management, definitely. The observation, breath observation, body scan techniques, loving kindness, self-compassion techniques have a lot of evidence as well. And overall evidence, I would say, it is effective in relapse prevention rather than the active care. For depression, at least, when people are depressed, it is better to use some behavioral techniques, cognitive techniques, interpersonal techniques. Once they get better, then they can use the mindfulness techniques. It prevents for any kind of relapse. For anxiety, it depends upon how you apply the mindfulness. If I teach only observation of breath, I don't think it's going to add to any kind of wisdom. But when you add the observation of breath with trying to arising, how they're feeling their body, how if you integrate all the four aspects of mindfulness, then I would say the evidence would be better. But right now I would say the evidence is very moderate. It is not like groundbreaking that everybody needs to meditate. Even without meditation, people can still change their behaviors, change the way they think. So I would say that a lot of work needs to be done in mindfulness.
So Karen, in reviewing the notes for our conversation today, I saw the four establishments of mindfulness, which I was really intrigued by. Could you tell me about how the Buddha's discourse on the four establishments of mindfulness came onto your radar and has been something that you integrate into your understanding of mindfulness?
So now for 18 years or for 20 years, rather, I've been practicing, three techniques of mindfulness. And I knew that these techniques were coming from Buddha's discourse of four establishments of mindfulness, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I heard about them, I read them, but I didn't pay much attention. The reason why I didn't pay much attention is whatever I was doing was working for me. Every time I would go for a 10-day meditation retreat, I feel refreshed and I feel very happy and so on and so forth. But after 20 years, I started to doubt the technique. I started to see the limitations in it. I felt I was stuck in a happiness loop. I was feeling happy, but there was no wisdom. Then I started to experiment mindfulness slightly differently. That's when I came across the original, discourse of the four establishments of mindfulness. Based on that, I started, developing my own techniques and practicing my own techniques. At least for the last 2 years, I've been practicing it. I did a self meditation retreat as well. So I feel somewhat confident talking about what Buddha's description is. In the Buddha's description, Buddha says, if we can train ourselves in such a way that we are aware of our body, we are aware of our mind, we are aware of our feeling, and we are aware of phenomena, within 7 days to 7 years, anybody who does it can feel completely liberated. So that is the Buddha's hypothesis. And the way Buddha describes the technique is also very straightforward. There is no inherent, you know, complexity in it. The first thing Buddha says is, you know, sit comfortably, you know, upright position. Bring your mindfulness to the front and just be aware that if you're inhaling, you know you're inhaling. If you're exhaling, you know you're exhaling. If your breath is long, you know your breath is long. If your breath is short, you know your breath is short. So Buddha is not saying where you need to concentrate on your mind or where you need to experience the breath. What Buddha is saying is, do you know, is your breath in breath or is it out breath? So that is what we need to train. If anybody can train in such a way, at any given moment, if I were to ask them, is your breath in breath or out breath? And if one is able to respond very quickly, such a person, in my opinion, for them, time slows down, Pete. You become the master of your mind. Your mind, you know, if you can train yourself not to have a thought, it's completely doable. Then Buddha says, with this in breath, you try to feel your entire body. With this out breath, you try to feel your entire body. With this in breath, you relax your body. With this out breath, you relax your body. So that is the mindfulness of body. This particular technique is what we imported into the secular mindfulness tradition, but we brought this technique into two techniques. We said just focus on the breath, in breath, out breath. The second technique is you do a body scan. Buddha never said we need to do a body scan. Buddha said you need to feel the breath, you need to feel the body. It's quite different from some of the mindfulness techniques that we are doing. These body scan techniques came later, you know, in the 16th century, 17th century, they were developed by monks, but it was not what Buddha said, you need to scan your body from top of the head. Buddha said you need to be aware of your breath and your body. I started practicing mindfulness that way, and then I realized, in fact, any physical pain that I experience in my body, with the power of my mind, I can tranquilize that pain. And, you know, I said, is it only me or is it something that others can also do? Because I felt so confident, so powerful, you know, hey, here is a sensation that I'm feeling. I'm experiencing this sensation with in-breath and out-breath. I'm telling myself, with in-breath, I tranquilize this pain. With out-breath, I tranquilize this pain. And this pain is melting away. Is it just coincidence or is it actually others can also do it? So I tested with one of my co-facilitators. I don't know if you know Laura. She does the ADHD group. So she was having a headache the other day, migraine the other day. You know? So I said, hey, would you be interested? I can teach you a mindfulness technique. You know, this pain, my prediction is this pain should dissipate after some time. After 5 minutes, she said, yeah, Kieran, this is melting away. Then I realized, okay, this mindfulness is very different from I've been practicing, or at least what is available in the Western literature. That is the mindfulness of body. And Buddha says, apart from body, you also need to be aware of your mind. The mind has a tendency where it can concentrate sometimes, it can distract, it get distracted sometimes. But you need to develop awareness, when is it getting concentrated, when it is getting distracted. And Buddha says our mind also is sometimes drowsy, sometimes alert, sometimes happy, sometimes unhappy, sometimes limited, sometimes liberated. You know, like Buddha describes different faculties of mind. We don't have any mindfulness techniques that talk about the mind in the Western psychology, or even in the Eastern psychology, even in these retreats done by monks. I don't think anybody does all these techniques. And Buddha says, you know, you also probe your mind. This is one of the interesting techniques. If you really want to overcome your anger or your lust or, you know, ill will, you check your mind, you know, in my mind, is there any greed in my mind at this moment? Desire for any sensual pleasures at this moment? Let's say if I'm addicted to alcohol, you know, I would ask myself, is there any desire or addiction for alcohol at this moment? Then you also ask yourself, is there any ill will or hatred in my mind at this moment? Is there any conceit in my mind at this moment? So I'll share a very interesting story with you. I've done all this, you know, I experimented with all these techniques. Is my mind concentrated or distracted? The more I practice, the mind became concentrated. Then I check my mind, is my mind drowsy or alert? The more I check, my mind became alert. Then I check, is there a greed in my mind? By then, my eyes were quite still. I was not experiencing any thoughts in my mind. When I checked, it's the right eye that moved, Pete. That has to do with the craving part, you know, like greed or desire. So that is the left brain, you know, because right eye is to do with the left brain, right? That has to do with planning. When I talked about, is there any ill will or, you know, hate in my mind? So it is the right brain that was getting activated, or my left eye that was tend to move. Because eye movement and thinking, there's a correlation there. And then I said, you know, is there anything, this is me or mine, no, including this body or including everything? Whenever the conceit arose, it was somewhere in here, you know, I was experiencing that thought. Because thoughts also happen in a geographical space in the mind, you know, right side, left side, in the center. But this is where it is felt. And I said, I realized, oh, this is where, based on my eye movement, these are the kind of thoughts that I'm arising. That is the mindfulness of mind. The third exercise is mindfulness of feelings. Where Buddha, this is the main exercise, according to Buddha, is there are three types of feelings we experience, which is pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant. We just become aware of these feelings all times, and you also see how they're arising and how they're passing away. That is what Buddha talks about. He doesn't give a particular method of how to do it, but that is the description. And the last, and that is what I started doing, mindfulness of feelings. I was using breath throughout, but I was checking, am I feeling pleasant? Am I feeling neutral? Am I feeling unpleasant? The more I started doing it, the pleasant feeling was becoming more pleasant, and I'm just like observing. I'm not craving. I'm not saying I like this, I want this. I'm not saying any of it. And I see the pleasant feeling becomes neutral, and that is where the mind feels very satisfied. And whenever the neutral feeling is there, and I ask myself, you know, when does the mind wander away? When does the craving arise? It usually happens during the exhalation stage. Because my investigation was everything is a conditioned phenomena. Everything that is arising is because of certain mind-body conditions. And what are those conditions is what I was investigating. That is the mindfulness of feeling. And my overall story is, I would say, feeling the mind the way it interprets is based on so many factors, you know. Even like the meal I would take, the first bite I would take, is it pleasant? That pleasant feeling is not just coming from the food. It is coming from when I'm eating. Yeah, did I have a good workout or not before I ate? Was I awake? When did I wake up in the morning? What am I thinking at this moment? The food is only contributing 30%. 70%, there are a lot of other factors. That is the mindfulness of feeling. And the last one is the mindfulness of phenomena. In this, we are just, you know, the Buddha says, just identify whenever you're meditating, there are five obstacles you'll experience. The first obstacle is craving. You know, you don't like, you like food or something like that when you're meditating, or aversion, you know, you don't like this experience, or you're thinking about someone you don't like. Or you may experience any kind of worry. You know, you're thinking about money, your relationship, something has been heavy on your mind and you're feeling restless as well. Or you're experiencing a doubt in your mind that, you know, hey, am I doing this technique correctly? Can I trust the instructor and so on? And the last one is drowsiness. You know, you may feel tired and the mind is cannot concentrate. So these are the five obstacles. And Buddha says you don't have to do anything about it. We just become aware of it. You can even take a mental note saying, oh, here I see craving as arising in the mind. I see aversion as arising in the mind. We just label it, experience it with in-breath and out-breath. You will see this experience will also change. And then Buddha says, other phenomena you need to be aware of is the seven enlightenment factors. If you do this technique, the way I'm telling you, you will experience seven stages. And the first stage is mindful. You know, your mind is completely aware. It's very open. As the mind is open, the second enlightenment factor is you start investigating how things are happening. As you're investigating, your energy levels increases. That is the third enlightenment factor. As your energy levels increases, you experience joy. This is a joy that is not based on the external world. It is based on your own investigation. That is the fourth enlightenment factor. The fifth one is, after joy, you experience tranquility and equanimity. So these are some of the enlightenment factors. So Buddha lays out the path. It is up to practice it. And I've experimented with all the four techniques for 1 year and with a long self-retreat. And I can say, you know, experiencing those seven enlightenment factors gave me confidence that I'm in the right track of doing the Buddha's, testing the Buddha's hypothesis. And they can be integrated into our day-to-day life by doing multiple types of, you know, mindfulness techniques.
This is a bit of a strange thought, perhaps. But as you were talking, I was thinking about my overall pessimism for humanity as far as our consumption patterns go, destroying the planet, things like that. And it struck me as, and I guess one of the reasons why I'm pessimistic in that respect is it feels like we're so dopamine driven. We have these built-in sort of needs to sort of consume. And then once you get to one plateau, you want more. And then once you get that, then you want more. There's this sort of like escalation that seems sort of insatiable. It feels like what you're laying out here could be a path towards providing a sustainable sense of growth and exploration and adventure within oneself, and not necessarily having to level the physical world in order to get that, if that makes sense. What do you think about that, Kieran?
I completely agree, Pete. The happiness that you can get by sitting with your own company is millionfold than anything outside can give.
Why do you think that is?
Because, you know, the craving is always there. You know, we can never extinguish that. Let's think about it this way. Everything has been taken care of. I never have to work anything, never have to do anything. I don't even have to meditate. Just sit and relax. Can the mind just sit and relax without thinking, without craving? It's impossible, Pete. You know, in other words, the craving, there is no end to it. None of our desires can ever be fulfilled by the objects in the outside world.
I totally agree. I mean, if I went back, this is a thought experiment I do with myself quite a bit. If I went back to my high school self and presented my high school self with some of the resources that I have available or professional accomplishments or things like that, I'd be like, oh man, I think you got it made. Like, never have another care in the world if that's exactly what life looks like. And of course, like, you know, like racked with the stress and worries and dealing with day-to-day hassles and, you know, how are my kids doing? And like, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter what the specifics are. But the point is that all these things that you imagine are going to fix all your problems very rarely do. In fact, they probably never do, I would say.
I agree. I would say happiness comes from inside. Completely, it comes from inside. The mind thinks it comes from outside. The mind is chasing. Once the mind reaches the goal and target, I mean, let's say I reach the, you know, whatever thing that I wanted to, I reach there. After that, I can't sustain that happiness all the time. There's a downhill there too, right? So that is how I would say, you know. So happiness is inside, and meditation is being comfortable with yourself. And if you enjoy your own company, you're happy.
There's another concept that you had wanted to introduce, the law of dependent origination. Could you maybe outline that just a little bit?
Yeah, this is called dependent arising, this law. Here, this is like quite distinct from the Four Noble Truths that Buddha has given. You know, Buddha has given, like, you know, after he got enlightened, at least 87,000 discourses or something like that, apparently. So in one of the discourse, Buddha was trying to make sense of this world and, you know, how everything works. And according to him, for us, what is important is the feeling part. According to Buddha, feeling arises because mind-body interacts, or the five sense organs come in contact with five sense objects. That is when a feeling arises. And the feeling is of three types, you know, pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant. From this feeling, craving arises. Craving means I like this, I want this. And from craving, clinging arises. This is me, this is mine. That is where the personality is formed. And from personality arises behavior. From behavior happens some kind of birth or creation. And then, you know, destruction, lamentation, sorrow, and so forth. You know, Buddha gives a circle. So then, you know, this is like a very intellectual circle. You know, these are the links of dependent origination, are very intellectual. But by doing the four foundations of mindfulness, you can actually examine those links within yourself. Because the feeling is the center point. Feeling arises because something is happening in the mind. Something is happening in the body. So you see the mind-body interaction, the feeling is arising. As the feeling is arising, you see the craving is also arising. You become aware of the craving as well, then that is the mindfulness of phenomena. By doing the four foundations of mindfulness, you're actually seeing the four links of conditioned arising. If you can see those four links, according to Buddha, this is the pathway for understanding and wisdom and happiness. In other words, the way the Western psychology and Eastern psychology differ is, in the Eastern psychology, we just say feeling. So in Eastern psychology, we say feeling as pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant. In the Western psychology, we say emotions. From a Buddhist perspective, emotion is nothing but feeling plus craving plus clinging. When you have these three links together, that is emotion.
I see such an interesting parallel to what you're saying, and the guest who I had on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Mark Solms, we were talking about the neurobiological basis of consciousness and the implications for therapists. And really, just sort of in a nutshell, one of the main take-homes was by understanding the workflow of the brain, we have the possibility of introducing some gaps into that workflow to introduce new information. And it was very much about sort of, you know, the brain isn't a reality detection machine. It's a reality prediction machine. You want to generate errors in prediction in order for new learnings to take place. I think this, what you're saying, is completely applicable to exactly the way that we know that the brain constructs our conscious experience.
I agree. There's another, you know, Buddhist, you know, idea here is about the self. What does the self comprise of? Self comprised of, according to Buddha, five aggregates, and one of it is body. I mean, the body as we know. The second is the mind, and of all the thoughts that we experience, you know, all different mind states. Third is feeling, pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant. And fourth is perception. So I would say all thinking is craving, except one type of thinking. When a thought is, this is in breath, this is out breath, this is anger, this is sadness, there's no craving involved. Is only perception. We are just recognizing. When the mind is only recognizing, there is perception and there is consciousness. All of them come together, and that is what gives sense of self or identity. We can also do another type of mindfulness technique where you just identify the body, the mind, feeling, perception, and consciousness. You keep doing it, you will go into an unconscious state and then you come back to the conscious state. You can experiment many different ways.
So Kieran, you had proposed perhaps in the outline that we actually even practice a mindfulness exercise for a few moments. Is that something you'd be game for?
Yeah, let's do it. So maybe we can do like a mindfulness of eating. What do you say, Pete?
Sure.
Do you have something that you can bring to the podcast?
I think through the magic of podcast editing, I could. All right, Kieran, I have procured the appropriate stimulus for the exercise we're about to embark on.
What did you get?
I have some tasty macadamia nuts.
Okay, perfect. So this is the experiment, Pete. So what you have to do is, you know, you take the bite and you have to ask yourself this question. Is it pleasant? Is it neutral? Or is it unpleasant? That is the first thing that you have to ask. You have to investigate. And make sure, one second. Make sure.
I'm hungry.
As soon as you put the food in the mouth, you will see that, you know, the chewing will happen very fast. Slow down the chewing because you really want to investigate. So ask yourself, is it pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant? And how is the mind determining it? You know, like on what basis is the mind interpreting this is pleasant? Is this neutral or is this unpleasant? So stay for the entire bite and at least take like three bites and then you can tell me what you felt.
Okay.
You want to take a second bite maybe? Do the same thing, you know, investigate.
Okay.
Look, you want to give it another shot or do you think you have enough data points to share?
I think I have enough data.
Okay. What's your observation?
The first go through was sort of neutral to negative.
Okay. Neutral to unpleasant. Yeah.
And you want to know the reason for that, correct?
Yeah, you can tell me. What is the condition for it?
There was a slight, these macadamia nuts are a little bit stale. There's a slight bitterness to them that I found really kind of like off-putting and violated the expectation I had for what the taste was going to be.
So it started out with unpleasant and then it went to neutral, you would say?
The second bite was very definitely neutral. And I also noticed that I started it quite mindlessly. I just went into it and then I had to remind myself, oh yeah, we're doing an exercise here. It was more neutral than the first time for sure.
Okay. So that is what would, you know, was it, were you surprised with your observations?
I have to say, I have never really examined that experience with that high of a resolution. I'm very mindlessly just usually eating them on the run or, you know, during a meeting or whatever, but to really just stop and sort of consider that really closely. I was surprised at the affect that was overlaid on top of that.
Yeah. Excellent. Good observation, in my opinion. I would say it's very hard, though, to do this, what you just did, because it's, you know, whatever the feeling is so intense, right? So the mind is craving, you know, it is thinking, it is doing. But you put all your craving into investigation, you really want to know how the mind is interpreting a feeling of such kind. The more you do it, every meal you do it, bite after bite you do it, you don't have to overeat. With even little food, you feel very satisfied, very happy. And you can also get rid of all the unpleasant foods that you're eating. You do the same thing with French fries. Neutral, neutral, unpleasant. You put the ketchup, then it becomes pleasant. What am I doing? French fries is out. Pleasant, neutral, unpleasant chips. Chips is out. You can actually, just through your senses, you can generally let go of a lot of, you know, cravings and addictions by doing this.
What about, I'm going to throw one at you that I would be really interested in hearing about, because this is something I hear a lot from clients, is insomnia. As people are trying to get to sleep, they have a craving to sleep, which of course paradoxically wrecks the experience of falling asleep. Like you can't be like, oh, I'm asleep now, this is great. Because by definition, you're supposed to be unconscious. So how can people undo or use the same sort of exercise to help to move past the craving to be asleep in order to actually get asleep?
Yeah, I would say like any relaxation exercises, mindfulness exercises would help to fall asleep. But I don't know if it is, you know, my own experience, but I think I can fall asleep within 3 minutes. Especially afternoon or in the nights, I can fall asleep. And the way I would fall asleep is using some of the mindfulness, you know, that I practice, is, you know, like feeling the breath, in-breath and out-breath, you know, just feeling the body. As you feel the body and the breath, the mind automatically feels relaxed. So the craving in the mind, we have to let go. If you want to be happy, we have to let go of the craving. So you have to tell to yourself, you know, if I don't fall asleep, no big deal, but let me just relax. And how do I relax? Feeling the breath and feeling the body. Because once the mind is not stimulated, there is no craving, it is very easy to fall asleep. The other technique I would do is, I would just concentrate on my eyes and just feel my breath. When I'm concentrating on my eyes, I don't have any thoughts in the mind, or the thoughts are very fragmented, or they're not that powerful to, you know, create a narrative. And then I just come back to my breath, and mind would slowly go into the subconscious level and fall asleep.
Excellent. That's really helpful. Kieran, is there anything that we haven't covered in the course of today that you wanted to make sure that we chatted about before we round up for today?
Okay, maybe I'll just share like a personal experience, like, you know, what really made me confident about the four establishments of mindfulness and, you know, the desire to come up with different meditation techniques. So as I was saying, you know, for 20 years, I practiced in a certain way, and I started to have doubts regarding the technique. And then, you know, I started to look for other teachers, you know, teachings and my own experimentation. And I did a slight difference in my practice. And I went for a 3-day meditation course, and this slight difference in my practice was, in the past, I used to concentrate my breath on my nostrils here. But then instead of concentrating here, I would just keep my attention in front of my eyes, and I would focus my breath on the body. That was a small difference that I did. I practiced it for 3 days, you know, in a meditation center. And I came back home and I saw something very profound happen, Pete. What I noticed was I was becoming aware of everything. You know, I was walking, I know I was becoming aware. I was putting the sugar in my tea, I know I was putting the sugar in my tea. In other words, the awareness came before the action or during the action. And I always felt that is very difficult to accomplish. See, in a sitting mindfulness position, you can be aware of your thoughts. But when you're walking, it's very difficult, because there's a body in motion. You cannot concentrate on your mental experience. You have to focus on the outside world. You have to focus on your movement and so on. So I felt that is very difficult. You know, a lot of like meditation teachers talk about, you know, be mindfulness of your behavior. But I was never able to do that part. But now this was happening automatically. Then that is when my curiosity increased, you know, this power of mind. So then I started to see, instead of seeing, you know, the world through a flashlight, I started to see my experience in the form of a tube light, because I was aware of a lot of things. And that is when I started to, you know, look at the four establishments of mindfulness And then I started to examine the body, then examine the mind feeling. And then I was able to see those, you know, the seven enlightenment factors. And then I started to experiment with my day-to-day life. You know, when I'm taking a shower, I would tell to myself, is it pleasant? Is it neutral? Or is it unpleasant? The more I do it, I realize both cold water shower is pleasant, the warm water shower is pleasant. The only difference is in the warm water, the mind wants it to stay a little bit longer. In the cold water, the mind says, it's all done. You can go back to your room. That's what the mind is saying. I started experimenting, you know, with my own self, food, all types of food I would eat. What is pleasant, what is neutral, what is unpleasant. The more I started experimenting, the more, you know, wisdom I started to have.
I've had a lot of interesting experiences with cold exposure. And I find that I'll try to take a really cold shower or turn my shower cold at the very end because I find it sort of wakes me up and it just kind of feels good. I'm not sure if there's any evidence behind it or whatnot, but I just kind of go with it. But I've noticed one thing I've used to overcome getting in there is the idea that it's just a sensation. And I found I get out of practice with it. Like if I haven't done it for a while, it's very aversive. But as I sort of build up that facility, I can just walk right in there and just be like, oh, there's a sensation of cold on my skin, but I'm completely detached from it, if that makes sense. It's just simply something I observe third party and I can stay in sort of indefinitely. You know, and obviously I don't, but the strength of that stimulus is a very good thing to practice against, I guess.
I agree. I think what I have noticed, I have been doing it for many years, you know, the cold water. When the COVID came, I stopped it. I used to take only cold water showers. But when the COVID came, I realized I don't have any pleasure in my life. Let me go back to my warm water shower. And I always felt cold water is unpleasant. You know, even for like 2 to 3 years of continuous, taking cold water, it never got pleasant. It is intense, but it was always, you know, somewhat neutral to unpleasant. It started to get more pleasant when I started to look at what pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant is. When I started to investigate, my understanding is the moment you look at your feeling, the feeling changes speed. The moment you pay attention, the feeling changes. I think there is some experiment in the physical world too, right? Physics, a double split experiment. The way you pay attention, it changes what you observe, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's a principle in social psychology or psychology in general too. By observing the phenomenon you want to study, you end up changing it invariably.
Exactly. So same thing, when you pay attention to a pleasant feeling, it immediately becomes neutral. When you pay attention to an unpleasant feeling, after some time, it becomes neutral too. That is the tendency there.
Just to feather in one more little point to that, I mean, one of the things that I find makes a cold shower pleasurable for me is the prediction embedded in that of how I will feel after. So there's a temporal kind of game that your mind plays as well.
Yeah, there are two aspects that are causing to that pleasant, you know, the summary feeling, what is pleasant. There are two aspects. One is the body part, one is the mind part. If mind is anticipating, mind is predicting, 50% to that pleasant feeling is going from the mind. The remaining 50% is coming from the body. If the body is tight, it tends to be unpleasant. And the body is relaxed, it tends to be pleasant. When the body has an equal distribution of heat, then it is pleasant. If the heat is somewhere concentrated, it is unpleasant. The different aspects of body and mind that contribute to that feeling stage. That competition, we are not aware. That competition is happening because of the old habit pattern of the mind. And that competition is what that needs to be changed.
Yeah, I think this is a real cue to the audience is, you know, whether it be food or a cold shower or exercise, anything, and just your day-to-day life is to take these opportunities to try to self-investigate just a little bit more what's going on vis-a-vis some of the steps that you've outlined today.
Yeah. And I would say my biggest complaint with the Western psychology or even the Eastern psychology, every psychology is we focus on unpleasant feelings, but we never focus on pleasant feelings. And we don't know how to engage with pleasant feelings. Would you agree? When the pleasant feeling comes, what comes is maximization, greed. You know, you go on a vacation, get drunk, feel very tired. But once you're done with the vacation, you come back to work, you say, I don't want to come back to work. So we don't know really how to engage with pleasant feelings and sensations.
Yeah, it feels like we just bypass the feeling and then it's more, I want more of that feeling.
Exactly.
Except we haven't even paused to feel the first round of it. It's more just sort of, it's more process oriented than it is outcome oriented, if I can put it that way.
Exactly. But we develop a little bit of awareness, and we don't have to push away the pleasant feeling. Don't have experiencing pleasant feeling. Just experience it completely. Then the pleasant feelings become satisfying. Same pleasant feeling doesn't become into an unpleasant feeling as well. So maybe like shifting, you know, focusing on pleasant feelings rather than only on the unpleasant feelings. In other words, instead of focusing on only on sadness, you also focus on how do you love someone? Do you love by grasping and clinging, or do you love by sharing and respecting? That's how I would approach.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting as a human being to really watch the way you engage with things in all matters, right? When love, indifference, jealousy, etc. It's so fascinating just to watch what you're really up to. There can be some unpleasant realizations in that, but I think better to have the realizations and have the possibility of maybe course correcting or engaging in some self-compassion around that than to be mindlessly walking that path anyway and then wondering why you have all these things happening in your life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Even like 3 times a day, you ask yourself, what am I feeling? Pleasant, neutral, unpleasant. I think that has a real power to be, you know, increase your awareness to different aspects of your life.
Well, Kieran, I really want to thank you for taking a bit of time out of your day to speak with me today. It was so nice to reconnect over some of these ideas that have come up in case discussions or just some of our informal discussions. I really appreciate your wisdom and expertise as far as helping me to get a little bit of a better sense of this space and what's going on with mindfulness, particularly the mindfulness of feelings.
Thank you for inviting me, Pete. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and we can discuss this further down, you know, as I keep experimenting and discovering something.
Exactly. Well, you've certainly prompted me to perhaps go on a bit of a voyage or adventure around this. I'd love to check back in with you and let you know how far I've progressed or not, and then to troubleshoot accordingly.
Super. Perfect. Thanks, Pete.
Okay. Thanks so much, Kieran. Take good care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.